How long they let me sit next to Malachi's unmoving body is uncertain to me. A while. Long enough for two of the other candidates to finish their tests. Or perhaps, after what happened to Malachi, they chose to stop instead of taking their chances. Giving Malachi's hand one last squeeze, I brush a lock of dark curly hair from his forehead and kiss his cheek. The room swoops and spins as I stand. After a moment, I am able to walk stiffly to my station. I balance on my stool and wait for the officials to move Malachi's body, but they don't. Not yet. Not until everyone has completed this phase of the test. I wait for the other candidates to protest, to say this is wrong. But I know why they don't. It's the same reason I don't yell out. The reason is Malachi and his too still body. We all want to live. Several minutes later, Will raises his hand to indicate he has finished and then closes his eyes so he won't have to see the shell of a boy he shared meals with. The girl to my right finishes. The testing official checks our work. When she is done, she signals the other officials to remove Malachi from the floor. My fellow candidates look at the tops of their desks or up at the ceiling. I don't. Malachi deserves someone who cares to bear witness. I force myself to watch every second, picking him up, carrying him by his arms and legs across the room, out the door, away. There is no time to grieve as the next boxes are brought in and placed on our tables. We are given permission to start. My hands tremble as I smell the blood still staining the floor. I force myself to take deep breaths, push myself to continue when I only want to run screaming from the room, leave the building, find my way back home. But I know that isn't possible, so I rub my hands on my pants, swallow my tears, and examine the box. I need several tries to figure out how to open it. Inside are soil samples and several capped beakers of solutions. We are to identify any soil samples that contain radiation. I use only the solutions I can identify by smell and color. Out of the 10 soil samples, there are 4 I am certain contain radiation, 3 that do not, and 3 on which I will not risk wagering a guess. Had this been the first test, before the plants, before Malachi's twitching, bloody body, I might have been arrogant enough to feign confidence. No more. Malachi made a mistake, and he paid for it. The price he paid would be worthless if I didn't learn from his actions. 4 more test boxes appear in succession. There is a keypad to enter our answers to complex mathematical equations. I only answer half, and am glad I didn't guess on the last, when the boy in front of me starts to shake. Electrocution. The punishment isn't as severe as Malachi's, but the boy can barely balance on his stool to work on the next 3 boxes. I identify about 3/4 of the slides they ask us to view, under what I suspect is a rigged microscope. Thankfully, we never learn what the penalty for mistakes would be. There is a solar power converter that I easily build, though the girl next to me ends up losing the tip of her finger, and 6 samples of water that we must purify using the chemicals provided. The purification test takes 2 hours, and we are instructed to drink the ones we think have been done correctly. I drink 2. The electrocuted boy and the girl next to me drink none. With that, the second round of tests is over. We are free to leave the room. Will can barely walk. From the stress, the water he drank, or one of the slower-acting plants he might have ingested? I don't know. But his legs tremble as he takes small, halting steps. I put my arm around his waist to lend my strength as we exit the testing room. In the doorway, I stop walking and take one last look back at where Malachi fell, where his blood has dried on the floor. A tear falls. I say a whispered goodbye. Then, with a steadying breath, I lead Will away, wondering who else will be missing when we reach our table. Boyd. According to an ashen-faced Nicolette, he collapsed during the third exam and was taken for treatment. He never returned. They all look at me and Will, who is now seated but needs help staying upright. Tears prick the backs of my eyes, and Tomas takes my hand and holds it. I am grateful to him for his support, for his survival. I share the story of our testing room as quickly as possible, telling myself it is like pulling off a bandage. The quicker you pull, the less agonizing the pain. But I am wrong. Fast or slow, relating Malachi's death digs a knife deep into my heart. Watching Tomas's jaw clench and Zandri's eyes fill with tears twists the knife until I don't know if I can keep breathing. The last of the testing candidates straggle into the hall and an announcement is made. All candidates who feel they are in need of medical attention, please report to the elevators. At least one candidate at every table gets up and heads back into the hallway. Nicolette tells Will he should go. He starts to rise, but I push him back into his seat and tell him not to. I study his face. His pupils are dilated, but his breathing has become easier. While his skin is still clammy, color is returning to his face. My gut tells me whatever caused this reaction is leaving his system. Do I think the right medicine would help him get better faster? Of that I have no doubt. But I remember Dr. Barnes' words spoken in the hallway as rime was being cut down from the ceiling, about the testing demonstrating the pressures a candidate can handle, about finding those who can deal with the pressures and still perform as leaders. I doubt those seeking medical attention will be deemed strong enough leaders to return. Nicolette pleads with me, but I will not let Will go. I can't. Dinner is served. I tell Tomas to get Will food and something to drink. That will help. I hope I'm right. Will does improve after drinking 2 glasses of juice and eating small bits of bread and fruit. Now that he can sit unassisted, I get food of my own. More than I can ever possibly eat, despite the fact that I'm not hungry. I eat some vegetables, a few bites of chicken, drink some juice. The 2 apples, the orange, the bags of raisins, and the rolls disappear into my bag one by one. I wait for my friends to finish eating and stow away anything they have left. Why? I'm not sure. At this point, I'm not sure of anything. I just know that being prepared for whatever comes is better than not being prepared at all. I notice most of the candidates stay in the dining hall until we are instructed to leave. The celebration of last night is a memory. Tonight, we are just glad to be alive. We return to our sleeping quarters. I sleep with the lights on, hoping Malachi and Boyd will not join Rhyme and Gil in my dreams. But Malachi comes. They all come. Only this time the terror in their eyes is for me. They warn me to be careful. Rhyme reminds me to trust no one while Malachi sings me a song from home. The anxiety of the night mounts with the morning announcement. When it is time to report for breakfast, I tell myself I am as ready for the day and what it might bring as I will ever be. Will gives me a smile as I reach our table. His eyes are sad, but no longer look sickly. Whatever strange plant he consumed has worked its way out of his system. He whispers a soft thank you and says Tomas's roommate sought medical treatment. He has yet to return. I force myself to eat, and this time I notice someone else slipping food into his bag. Tomas sees me watching and nods as the loudspeaker crackles to life. Congratulations, candidates, for reaching the team testing phase. For this exam, you will be placed in groups of 5. Due to the number of candidates who remain, one group will comprise only 4. When you hear your name called, please walk to the hallway to join your testing group. Best of luck to you all. There are 5 of us at our table. I don't even have the chance to hope we will be called together when Tomas's name is announced, along with those of 4 other candidates I don't recognize. Tomas touches my arm as he slings his bag over his shoulder and walks out. Several minutes pass before the next group is called. Both Will and Zandri promise to see us later and disappear out the door. Nicolette and I stare at each other as group after group leaves the room. Finally, Nicolette's name is called along with 4 others. She and I will not be testing together. Dread churns my breakfast as I scan the room and see the scruffy boy who tripped Malachi on our first day still seated at a table. He, along with a tall, muscular blonde boy and a red-haired girl I remember from my written exams, will be in my group for this test. The only group of 4. Do we wait for our names to be called or save them the trouble? This from the redhead. I smile at her and stand. If we haven't figured out our group by now, we probably don't belong here, right? The 2 boys stay seated, but the redhead rises. She joins me in the hall and holds out her hand. On her wrist, I see a half circle surrounded by the 8-pointed star symbol we share. Annalise Walker, Grand Forks Colony. Sea of Vale, 5 Lakes. She gives me a wide grin. I know. 5 Lakes candidates are all anyone from my colony has been interested in talking about. I wince. What have they been saying? Most figure you're easy competition. They equate small colonies with simple-mindedness. The self-satisfied smile on her face makes me ask, and you? One of the guys from my colony has the same 8-pointed star symbol. He's the only person who scored higher than me in class. I used to study for weeks in order to beat him, but I never could. She shrugs as though to show coming in second didn't bother her at all. But the glint in her eyes tells a different story. Smiling, she adds, "If 2 of you from 5 Lakes made it into the same testing group as the 2 of us, I'd say the rest of the candidates are pretty stupid to overlook you." The loudspeaker announces, "Malencia Vale, Brick Baron, Roman Fry, and Annalise Walker, report to the hallway." Brick. Roman. I try to decide which name belongs to which boy as they stride toward us. Before I can ask, a testing official in red leads us into the elevator and pushes the button for the 4th floor. We are led to a white room with a table surrounded by 4 chairs. On the far left side of the room is a large wooden door with a green light blinking above it. In the center of the table are 4 pencils and 4 booklets marked with our symbols. The knots of worry loosen as I see the paper. While I have no idea what the pages contain, I am certain of one thing. A written test contains no immediate threat. None of my friends will die from a test today. Once we take our seats, the testing official explains. Today's test will evaluate your ability to work as a team. On the table in front of you are booklets filled with 5 sample questions. Each sample problem requires specific skills to solve. As a group, you must decide which team member has the skills best suited to solve which sample problem or problems. Those same skills will be required to solve a corresponding problem in one of the 5 individual examination rooms. Once you have determined who the best person to solve each problem is, the person you have selected for the first problem will go through this door. She points to the door with the green light. Once you have walked through this door, the light above it will turn red. Follow the hallway to the end. There you will find 5 doors marked with a number. The numbers correspond to the same problems in your booklet. There is also a door marked exit for when you have completed your portion of the exam. Open the door marked with the number of the question your team selected you to answer. Inside, solve the problem as best you can. When you have completed your portion of the exam, indicate you are finished by going through the exit door. The light above this door will then turn green. This will signal it is time for the next candidate to begin. Everyone in the group will be given credit for all the correct solutions on the exam that are not only your own. The idea of being scored based on someone else's work makes me uncomfortable, but Annalise's confident smile banishes some of the doubt. The testing official isn't done. Because there are only 4 of you in the group, one candidate will be responsible for solving at least 2 of the problems. Once a problem has been answered, the door to that problem cannot be opened again. Any attempt to resolve an already completed problem will result in a penalty for the student making the second attempt to solve that problem. You have 1 hour to discuss your strategy. The official pushes a button and the green light is replaced by red. Once the green light is turned on, you can begin the test. There is no time limit to the exam. Take as much time as you need to get to know one another's strengths and weaknesses. Good luck. The sound of locks being engaged accompanies the testing official's exit. The only way out of this room is through the testing exam doors. The 4 of us look at one another for a moment. I am the first to grab the booklet marked with my symbol. The tall, muscular blonde boy grabs one with what I think is an anchor surrounded by a heart. The X surrounded by a circle belongs to the scruffy kid. Something about this test makes me apprehensive. Maybe it is the simplicity of the instructions or the idea that someone else will get credit for my work and me for theirs. Whatever it is, my gut tells me there is more to this test than meets the eye. I don't have to think about what that might be as Annalise takes charge. How about we solve the sample problems 1 at a time? Once everyone is done with a problem, we can compare notes. That should help us figure out who should do which problem, right? Since none of us has a better idea, we take her suggestion and get to work. The first problem is mathematical, a one-dimensional heat equation to determine the flow of heat in a rod where everything but the ends are insulated. These are equations I have used often and make me smile as I get to work. I'm surprised when the scruffy boy, whose name turns out to be Roman, finishes before me and has the same answer as mine. Annalise's answer also matches. Brick's does not. One by one, we work through the problems in the book, a history section that requires dates, names, and population sizes for the colonization of the United Commonwealth. A biology question that asks for the DNA mapping of a rock wolverine that resembles a wolf but is actually a mutated version of a nibbling cat. While I'm answering the question about solar power, the red light turns green. Our testing can begin at any time. Maybe the pressure of the light distracts me from fully concentrating on the last problem that details the principles of nuclear weaponry. I'm the last one in the group to complete the final question. Brick is first to finish. His answer agrees with the other 2. My answer matches no one's. Out of 5 questions, my answers match at least 1 of the others 4 times. Annalise also gets 4 matches. Brick matches answers on 2. Roman's first answer is his only correct one.
"Guess that means I go first, right?" he says.
Of the members of the group, I am by far the youngest. At home, my natural inclination would be to hear everyone else's opinions before offering mine. But something about his enthusiasm rubs me the wrong way. So instead of waiting, I say, "The testing official didn't say the problems have to be completed in order. We just have to determine the order the members of our group go in to solve the problems." Roman folds his arms across his chest and scowls.
"That's not what I heard."
I look at Annalise. She chews her bottom lip and closes her eyes as though trying to recall the exact words. When her eyes open, they're filled with apology. "I think Roman could be right. We could try it another way, but if we do, we could fail. That's a risk I'm not willing to take." Roman smiles. Brick shrugs and nods. 3-1. Just like that, the discussion is over. Annalise leads the decision-making. Roman will answer the first problem. She will answer the second and third. I will answer the fourth. Brick the fifth. I suggest that I might be better suited to the third question, since my father's work has given me a strong understanding of genetics. But Roman and Annalise disagree. Brick refuses to give an opinion. Part of me wonders why, as Roman gets up and says,
"See you all after the test."
He turns the handle on the green-lit door and walks out without a backwards glance. The light turns red, and we wait. At first, we try to chat. Annalise asks Brick about his home, and we learn he's from Roswell Colony. His parents are both university graduates. They work at a former military facility where together they develop weapons and security methods for colonies plagued by animal attacks. No wonder he excelled at the nuclear science question. As the minutes tick by, though, our conversation becomes more stilted. There is more time in between questions, shorter answers, until we no longer talk. We just wait for the light to change. There is no clock, no windows to measure the movement of the sun, no way to know if the time that passes is as long as it feels. My shoulder muscles tighten. I see Annalise roll out the tension in her neck. Brick is the only one who appears unfazed by the long wait. He closes his eyes. Annalise gnaws on her thumbnail. I stretch my muscles. Every minute feels like 10. Never do I lose sight of the light. Finally, it changes. Annalise stands and smiles. "My turn. I bet I can do both my problems in less time than it took for Roman to do his." "Don't rush," I warn, and I feel my face flush as I realize my words could imply criticism. "We're okay waiting," I say. "Take as long as you need." Annalise's smile fades as her eyes meet mine. In their depths, I see nerves and a touch of fear lurking behind the bravado that I have in this short time come to admire. Then the smile is back as she nods. "I promise to kick butt on questions 2 and 3. The rest is up to the two of you." The door closes. The red light returns. So does the silence. Brick sits unmoving. His calm, silent demeanor has the opposite effect on me. I stand and pace the room as my stomach begins to growl. I am certain it is far past lunchtime. It is obvious that no meals will be provided until this test is complete. And maybe that's part of the test, to see if candidates will stay focused despite the desire for food. My mother always insisted I eat everything on my plate on mornings before important tests. She said the brain and body need fuel to operate at the highest level. I dig through my bag from my stash of food and find myself deciding between a roll filled with raisins and nuts and an apple. Since the roll is easier to split with Brick, I start to pull it out when I realize they are two of the items I selected for dinner the first night of the testing. I count back the days. Less than a week has passed, but everything has changed since that night when the four of us from Five Lakes arrived and took our table. Now Malachi is gone, and I am working in a group with the boy who tripped him. Did Roman stick out his leg for spite? For fun? Did he think it would intimidate Malachi into doing less well on the exams, thereby giving Roman a better chance of passing? Maybe. Roman only got one answer correct today. How smart can he be? The work he did on the final problem was so illogical, I found it hard to believe he had made it through the first two tests. Wait. I reach for the booklet marked with the X and the circle. Roman's handwriting is neater than I would have suspected, based on his appearance. Hearing my mother's voice warn not to let appearances deceive me, I read through the pages of numbers and formulas for the first problem. The work impresses me. While I also got the correct answer, Roman was able to calculate several steps in his head, which is why he finished first. His work makes it clear why he was chosen for the testing. He's smart. Very smart. Which is why his answers to the other questions make no sense. Gibberish fills those pages. We had all been so concerned with who gave the correct answers to the problems, we never bothered to check the pages that preceded the final solution. Roman's scribbles made one thing obvious. He wasn't concerned with coming up with the right solutions. He was just wasting time. Why?
See ya.
I jump as Brick's voice breaks the silence and follow his gaze to the light above the door. Green. If I were to make a guess, less than a half hour has passed since Annalise walked through the door. Could she have finished her problems in so little time? Hands shaking, I grab the booklet marked with the other eight-pointed star and start flipping the pages. Yes, her writing is clear, concise, confident. Her logic shows no flaws that I can see. If anyone could whiz through two tests in far less time than it took another candidate to do one, it would be Annalise. Still.
Are you going to go in? Brick asks.
In a minute, I say. Going through the door is my only option. The only way to get past this test. It's what happens once I am through that door that is in doubt. I think back to the testing official's instructions. Roman's insistence that he go first. One answer allowed per question. The scores to the answers provided count for all. Any attempt to resolve a question will be punished. Annalise's testing booklet falls from my fingers and my legs go weak as the pieces click into place. Roman's lack of effort on the other problems. The length of time it took for the red light to turn green during his turn. Dr. Barnes told us the third test would evaluate our ability not only to work well with others, but to evaluate their strengths and weaknesses. If I am correct, Roman evaluated our group perfectly and has set the rest of us up to walk into a trap. A trap Annalise must have already sprung. I sit hard on the chair behind me and take deep breaths, trying to stave off the panic. If I am right, I cannot attempt to answer the problem my team assigned me. If I am wrong, not answering the problem could result in my failure. I have to decide what I believe. My heart pounds as I look at Brick. His calm demeanor and poor performance on the practice problems take on a sinister tone. Does he know about Roman's plan?
Did they plot this together? Brick's practice book might present me with the answers, but the booklet is currently resting under his elbow on the table in front of him. To get the booklet, I have to explain my concerns. If he isn't involved in Roman's trap, Brick will learn about it from me and gain the opportunity to pass when he doesn't deserve to. Shame. Hot, deep, oily, stomach-churning embarrassment fills me. My thoughts make me no better than the person I believe Roman to be. I will not stoop so low as to trick others in order to eliminate the competition. While I am horrified at the methods employed with the testing, I seriously doubt the testing officials who rate us at the end will approve of trickery either. What kind of leader would that type of person make? Mimicking Brick's calm demeanor, I carefully explain what I believe Roman's plan is, what I think happened to Annalise, what could possibly happen to us if we attempt to solve the problems we have been assigned. Brick listens without interruption, and when I fall silent, considers me for a long time before saying,
"We said we would answer the agreed-upon questions."
Does he not believe me? No, his expression is not one of disbelief, but of resignation. Roman agreed to work as a team, but I don't think he is. If we answer an already answered question, we'll be penalized. I can see the nail enter Malachi's eye, the blood, the trembling body crumpled on the floor. Knowing what could happen makes me want to shake Brick's stoic shoulders as his head moves side to side, while once again saying he gave his word. His parents taught him to respect a promise. End of story. Desperation claws at my heart even as I wonder if he's right. If I'm wrong, if Roman answered only his question, if not answering ours will be the biggest mistake we could make. Hitching my bag onto my shoulder, I walk slowly across the room. I have done all I can to help Brick survive the day. If he doesn't, please. Turning, I walk back to Brick and take his hand in mine. You don't know me. There's no reason you should trust what I say. I can't tell you what to do. I can only ask that you look at Roman's booklet and think about who has the most to gain by betraying the others. If he solved all five problems, anyone who attempts to solve them again will be penalized. I don't know what the penalty is. I see the nail enter Malachi's eye again and swallow the bile that rises in my throat. But if I'm right, three of us could be eliminated from the testing because we trusted our teammate. For a moment, the composed expression disappears, replaced by confusion.
I'm not from your colony. Why do you care what I do?
Because I don't want anyone else to die. Brick looks over my shoulder at the door behind me, the green light telling me it is time for me to make my choice. Letting go of his hand, I open the door, give one last look at my teammate, and walk through, hoping I did enough to save Brick's life. Hoping I am confident enough in my own deductions to save my own. The hallway is dimly lit. The shadows fill me with unease as I follow the corridor to the end. As promised, another hallway lined with six illuminated doors greets me. To my right is the door marked with the number 4, the door I promised to walk through. To my left are doors 1 through 3. I cross to door 2, looking for signs of what? Blood? Hair? Something to prove my theory right. The silver doorknob gleams in the light. There are no smudges on it to bear witness that it had been handled. I check the other doorknobs, all perfectly polished. I walk back to door number 4 and trace the black number on the snow-white door.
Do I keep my word and turn the handle? Or go with my gut and walk away? How long do I stand in front of the door? I don't know. But when I finally make my choice, my knees protest as I shift my weight. Touching the doorknob, I take a deep breath and step away from the door. Turn to the right, walk two doors down to the one marked exit, and turn the gleaming knob, hoping the choice I have made is not my last. Chapter 9. A testing official is waiting inside a small room containing a dark wooden table, a chair, and a control panel of some kind. It's probably what makes the light we watched go from red to green. The official's expression is pleasant as she leads me through a back door, down well-lit hallways to the bank of elevators. The testing official stays on the elevator as I exit onto the fifth floor, wondering how and when I will learn my fate. I hear the sounds of conversation from the dining hall and realize that I might not need to wait. The person with the answer to whether I made the correct choice is right through those doors. My heart leaps as I see Tomas, Will, and Zandri sitting at our table, but I do not join them, not yet. Instead, I scan the room. I spot Roman before he sees me, laughing with friends. At a joke, or at those of us who might have been eliminated because we believed him? Tomas calls my name, but I don't move from my position in the doorway. The girl next to Roman jabs him with her elbow. His eyes turn and meet mine. And I know. The disbelief and anger in his eyes tell me I was right not to trust him. I just wish I had figured out the truth sooner. If I had, Annalise might be seated at one of these tables. There is no sign of her red hair and confident smile. A small part of me hopes she is relaxing in her room, though if she is, I am almost guaranteed a failing grade. I feel Roman's eyes follow me as I grab a bag of crackers from the snacks on the table and walk across the room to sit with my friends. Tomas, Will, and Zandri tell me about the problems they solved. From the way they talk, I begin to understand that while we all had the same types of problems to complete, every group solved them in a different order. Tomas answered the third question for his team, the math question Roman was supposed to answer for ours. Zandri went first for her team and answered the history problem. Will went second and was assigned genetics. Everyone from Tomas's group has returned from the exam. Zandri and Will are still waiting for the rest of their teammates to arrive. As I watch the door, they ask which question I was assigned. In a quiet voice, I tell them about my belief in my teammate's betrayal, my decision not to open the door, to leave before answering my question. My friends stare at me. A knot forms in my chest. Will recovers first and says he's impressed I trusted my instincts. That he was glad he never had to make a choice about trusting his teammates, since Zandri was the only one who went before him. And of course he trusted her. Tomas looks at Will for several long moments before saying he's proud that I alerted Brick to my suspicions. Will tells a joke to make me feel better, but I don't. Xandri's wide eyes and trembling lips and the way Tomas frowns when he doesn't think I'm looking remind me that the verdict to this test is still in doubt. There is still a chance that I made a mistake, that I failed. And when Brick appears in the doorway, I am certain I did. My heart drops. Brick had been adamant about following through with his promise. And when he passes my table without a glance, I'm positive he did exactly what he swore to do. Brick solved his question. He knows I was planning on not answering mine. Now I am forced to wonder, did I ruin the chance for all of us to pass this test and continue on?
Nicolette arrives full of stories about her teammates. Some were nice, one was pushy and arrogant. Her group made the arrogant boy go last, just in case he got any ideas about messing up the test for the others. I turn a cracker over in my hands and listen to everyone talk about the personalities of the candidates they were grouped with. Xandri shoots looks at the door as she watches for her other test teammates to arrive. I realize Tomas has fallen silent. He's watching our friends closely. Out of the corner of my eye, I see him looking at me. Does he think I'm paranoid? Maybe I am. Time passes slowly as more candidates arrive looking triumphant or tired, sometimes both. Eventually, dinner is served. I force myself to eat. With every bite, I cast a look at Brick, willing him to make eye contact, to give me a sign of the choice he made. As we finish with our meal, a voice over the loudspeaker says, "Phase 3 of testing is now complete. Failing results will be delivered to candidates' rooms within the hour. For those who pass, I wish you a good night's sleep. Preparation for the final phase of testing will begin tomorrow." My friends rise and head for the exit. I pretend to adjust my bag's strap and remain seated until Brick walks past. He never looks in my direction. For the next hour, I watch the clock in my room as the minutes tick past. I hear the sound of someone crying. I flinch as footsteps come near, but no one knocks or opens my door. After the allotted time passes, the hallway grows silent. I know I have passed. I should feel joy, but as I climb into bed, there is only numb fatigue and the hope that I am up to the challenge of whatever tomorrow will bring. The morning announcement comes with the dawn. We are to bring all our belongings with us when we report for breakfast. I dress quickly and lace up my worn leather boots as a sense of dread grips my stomach. My friends are all at breakfast the next morning. We have made it to phase 3, although Xandri's red-rimmed, tired eyes and withdrawn demeanor show that success has not come without a price. I look around the room and spot Brick sitting at the back table. This time his eyes make contact. For a moment we just stare at each other. When he nods, I recognize his gratitude. An hour passes before the loudspeaker invites us downstairs. Around the room I see people suck in air. Some, like Xandri, let out low whimpers. Others, like Tomas, look concerned but resigned. Even the cockiest, like Roman, show signs of fear. Yes, the testing has exacted a price from us all, and that payment isn't over. There is still one test to go. Dr. Barnes once again waits for us in the third floor lecture hall. Today he is wearing a serious expression that makes everyone in the room fall silent. "Congratulations to all of you for making it to the fourth round of testing. There were 108 candidates in this year's testing class. 59 of you remain. Tomorrow will begin the longest phase of our testing, the practical examination. University students are the future leaders of the United Commonwealth, because some of you in this room will soon be designated as among those leaders. We believe it is necessary for you to understand fully the challenges you will face. You will travel to a non-revitalized part of the country and be placed in a designated starting location. When the test begins, you must then find your way from that location back to Tosu City. Those who return will be given a passing grade and will qualify for the final evaluation.
That evaluation will determine the candidates who will attend the university. Terror. That's the only word I can think of to describe what I feel. Alone in an unfamiliar part of the country. Or not alone, not really. Animals. War fallout mutations of animals that were once harmless but are no longer. And drifters, those who have chosen not to join the United Commonwealth. People who believed structured governments led to the seven stages of war and abandoned those who sought organization. Those people might be out there too. And just me, by myself, to face them. Each candidate will begin the test independent of each other. That does not mean you have to remain alone. You may choose to team up with other candidates. You may also choose to impair the progress of your fellow candidates in order to ensure that you obtain a passing grade before them. What choices you make during the test will be considered in your final evaluations. Tomas takes my hand and holds it tight. The pressure of his fingers and the implied support calm me enough to focus. If I am going to pass this test, I need to focus. A screen descends behind Dr. Barnes. A map flickers on the screen. At the bottom left corner of the map is a silver star. Next to the star are the words Tosu City. On the top right is a large black star next to a blue body of water. The black star is labeled Start. Aside from the stars, the one body of water, and the name of Tosu City, the only detail provided on the map are two lines, one red and one blue. The red runs on a diagonal from just about the starting point to a few inches above the silver star. The blue line starts several inches below the starred location and runs to just south of Tosu City. All candidates will travel from your designated starting position through the area in between the blue and red boundaries to Tosu City. Both lines indicate fences that have been erected by testing officials to help you understand and stay within the boundaries of the testing area. Any candidate who leaves the testing area at any time will be given a failing grade. Please do not make us enforce this rule. Malachi's bloody face flashes in front of me. Rhyme's bulging, bloodshot eyes. Annalise's now empty chair. Judging by Dr. Barnes' serious expression and the tone of his voice, there is no doubt what penalty a failing grade will bring. As soon as you are dismissed, each of you will meet with a testing official who will give you further instructions. Dr. Barnes sighs and slowly looks around the room, letting his gaze settle on each and every candidate. Please be safe and smart. It is my dearest hope that each and every one of you returns to Tosu City. He straightens his shoulders and tells us to watch the screen behind him. When our symbol flashes on the screen, we are to stand and join our assigned testing official in the hallway. He wishes us luck and then leaves the stage, walking down the aisle and out the door without a backwards glance. The first symbol flashes on the screen, and a boy down in front rises. Still holding my hand, Tomas leans over and whispers, "The starting point is Chicago." I think back to the map that flashed on the screen. Consider the water and the distance between it and Tosu City, and nod. I'd been too stunned to recognize it from the maps we'd studied in school. Even without any additional identifying landmarks, I'm certain Tomas is right, and wonder how we can use that knowledge to our advantage. Tomas is one step ahead of me. Talking quietly in my ear, he tells me to find the tallest building still standing. Go there. He'll meet me. If we don't find each other in the first 24 hours, I'm to travel due west until I reach the fencing that is the northern boundary of the test. We'll find each other there. Partners. We will do this together. Two plans. Two hopes that I will not have to travel hundreds of miles on my own. I nod and squeeze his hand to show him that I agree, that I will do my best to find him, as a symbol of an eight-pointed star with a lightning bolt flashes on the screen. My mouth goes dry. I don't want to let go of Tomas's hand, but I convince each finger to uncurl. I move away from the strength Tomas's presence has lent me, and I stand. Hoisting my bag onto my shoulder, I touch each one of my friends. Tomas, Zandri, Will, Nicolette, on the cheek as I pass. When I walk into the hallway, I can't help feeling a small burst of relief at the face waiting for me. Michael. His expression is stern, but I can see a spark of pride that I am still here. Or maybe I am just imagining that because when he asks me to follow, his tone is formal, as though we have never met. We take the elevator to the first floor and exit left down a long gray hallway. At the end of the hall, we stop in front of a large gray door. "This is the testing storeroom," Michael says. "Each testing candidate is allowed 10 minutes inside this room. During that time, you will select 3 additional items to help you successfully complete this test. I will log your choices as you make them. At this time, I am supposed to remind you to choose carefully. Your choices can mean the difference between success and failure. Of course, I doubt you would have made it this far if you hadn't already figured that out." This time I am certain I don't imagine the glint of pride in his eyes. He tells me my 10 minutes start when I open the door. I take a deep breath and turn the handle. Outdoor clothing, sensible shoes, food, compasses, first aid bags, travel gear, fire-making kits, fishing poles, knives, guns, and more. Everything you could need to stay alive, and I am allowed to take only 3. I feel Michael's presence behind me as I walk slowly past tables, racks, and shelves stacked with life-sustaining items. Once again, I am grateful for my broken-in boots. Most girls will need to exchange their fashionable footwear for something they can hike in. My thievery in the dining hall also has paid off. While a half dozen apples, rolls, and bags of dried fruit won't get me all the way to Tosu City, I know I have enough to get me by, for now. So I ignore those options and study the rest. All of it seems necessary. I feel the time I am allotted for my selection ticking away as I try to decide what I really, truly need. Tucked in the corner is a deep green bag with a small stamp that reads H2O. My hands pull the bag from the pile and investigate. Inside are 2 canteens filled with water and a small kit of the chemicals we used during the second test. I think back to the map. The testing zone is large. I am certain the area must be filled with lakes, streams, and creeks, though they hadn't been marked on the map. Between conversations with my father and Dr. Barnes' words, I know most, if not all, of the designated testing area has yet to be revitalized. That means the water within the boundaries is most likely contaminated in some way. Not all contaminations will kill, but many cause illness, especially in the tired and malnourished. I will risk both during this phase of the testing. I will not risk dehydration as well. One choice made. Sliding the green bag onto my shoulder, I consider my other options. The tent with its rainproof fabric and insulated floor is oh so tempting. But just lifting the case makes the decision for me. While it doesn't feel heavy now, there are more than 700 miles to travel. After the first 10, the tent will feel more burden than blessing. Comfort must take a back seat to survival. I skip by the compass since I have one on the transit communicator I borrowed from Zine. I also skip past the knives and the fire starting kits. I have the pocket knife I brought from home. I will make do. As for fire, it will take me a while to build one without the assistance of matches or flint, but I can do it. It is one of the first skills they teach new students in Five Lakes Colony. For the fire kits to be included here among the survival gear, I have to wonder if our small size and remote location made this a lesson unique to us. The stash of crossbows, guns, and explosives catches my attention. If an animal attacks, I do not want to be caught unprepared. I've never fired a crossbow and immediately scratched that off my list. The explosives are unfamiliar and scare the crap out of me. I have fired my father's shotgun, and Daylene's dad taught us to fire his pistol. Daylene is a much better shot, but I can hit the center of the target at least 75% of the time. I finger the shotgun, which I am more comfortable with, but it only comes with a box of 10 shells. My fingers shift and close over a small black handgun that comes with 2 boxes of ammunition. Lightweight, easy to carry, enough bullets that I can take a few practice shots without worrying about running out. Second choice complete. The gun and the 2 boxes of ammunition disappear into my bag as Michael warns there are 2 minutes remaining. My heart skips as panic sets in. 2 minutes and I have no idea what else to take. Signal flares to help Tomas find me? A sleeping bag? A raincoat? A manual on hot wiring old-fashioned cars? Will there be cars? I don't think so, but how can I know? Closing my eyes, I take 2 deep breaths and make a list of what I do have. Food, water, clothes, a knife and small tools. A transit communicator, complete with compass. A gun for self-defense. But what if I get injured? I open my eyes and head for the medical kits. Each one contains bandages, a needle and thread, and antibacterial ointments, along with some radiation tablets, mild pain fever medication, and other bottles I don't have time to examine now. I shove the medical kit into my bag and sling it onto my shoulder as Michael announces, "Time's up." Turning my back on the supplies, I follow Michael out the door, trying to ignore the nagging worry that I have made a mistake. But there is no going back. My 3 choices have been made. Whatever else I need, I'll just have to find as I go. Michael checks his watch and leads me down the hallway to a room marked with my symbol. He opens the door. Inside is a small sleeping chamber and an adjoining bathroom. "You have an hour to repack your belongings or change clothes." He looks at me and smiles. He knows I won't be changing into anything, but his words and expression let me know this is a script he must follow. It also tells me something else. If Michael is being this careful, there are people listening to what is being said. "If you need anything during the hour, please let me know. I'll be right outside." The door closes, and I sit on the small twin-sized bed. Everything in the room is decorated in shades of gray. Not exactly the most uplifting place I've ever been in, but it could be worse. In fact, I am certain it very soon will be. I strip off my clothes, shower, and wash my hair. Once I'm clean, I contemplate myself in the reflector before pulling my hair back at the nape of my neck and twisting it into a tight knot. I have no idea what I will be facing when the test begins, but I cannot afford to let my cascading hair get in the way. If during the test I have to cut it off, I will. Vanity has no place here. Boots laced up, I empty my bag on the floor and repack. I remove one canteen of water to keep handy and store the rest of the kit on the bottom of the bag along with my clothes. The medical kit goes in next. Then the food I took from the dining hall gets wrapped in a towel from the bathroom. No one said we couldn't take them. And stowed. Last, the final canteen, Zine's transit communicator, and the gun. The knife I put in my pocket. I lift the bag. It isn't as light as it used to be, but I've distributed the weight well. I can run with it if I need to. The end of my hour is signaled by a knock on the door. Michael is waiting. He takes in my hair, my unchanged clothes, the single bag hanging from my shoulder, and nods. Follow me. He leads me through a series of hallways until we come to an elevator. This time he pushes a button for a floor I've never seen before. UG. When the doors open, it is very clear by the mildew scent what UG stands for. Underground. According to Michael, we will travel by an underground moving walkway system to the outskirts of the city. A skimmer will then transport us to my designated starting area. The tension and worry I've been carrying diminish when I spot the underground walkway. It is a large conveyor belt that hums along the floor, and I can't help but ask Michael dozens of questions about how it works, how large the network is, and how it is powered. He smiles and tells me he'll answer what he can while we travel. I stumble as I step onto the belt, but Michael catches me before I end up on the ground. The walkway ride lasts the better part of an hour, much of it traveling through dimly lit tunnels. Several times we have to step off one walkway and climb onto a new one. I'm grateful for Michael's presence as he continues a steady stream of conversation. Concentrating on his voice helps me ignore the anxiety blooming in my stomach. We arrive at our destination and step off the walkway. An elevator zooms us to the surface, where Michael says our lunch awaits. The elevator lets us off into a large room, bustling with testing officials. One official in purple holding a clipboard spots us and hurries over. He makes note of my identification bracelet symbol, scribbles something on his board, and tells Michael to take me to number 14. Number 14 turns out to be a well-lit but airless skimmer docking bay. In the corner is a small table holding a large picnic lunch. Michael will stay with me here in this room until I've gone through the next step of testing preparation, whatever that might be. A tiny window next to the table looks out onto a green field of grass. Beyond the grass is sparkling water. After being inside for most of the last few days and not knowing whether I will ever see healthy land like this again, I ask Michael if we can eat lunch outside. He is about to say no, but I must look pretty desperate because he tells me to wait here while he asks one of the upper-level officials. I take one look at Michael's face when he returns and give a whoop of joy. Michael grabs the basket of food and tells me we have exactly 1 hour to spend outside. He presses a small button on the wall, and the docking bay door rises. A moment later, we stroll into the fresh air. Picking a spot near a large tree, I admit. I'm surprised they let us come outside.
As long as I'm with you and you aren't able to communicate with other testing candidates, there's no reason to say no.
He hands me an apple from the basket and smiles.
To tell you the truth, most testing candidates are happy to follow instructions. The testing committee is always interested to see which candidates show a bit more initiative.
Even now, before we are thrown into the wreckage of our country, we are being tested. It shouldn't surprise me, but it does. My eyes run up and down the length of the tree, looking for signs that our words are being recorded, that we are being watched.
Michael smiles. Don't worry, our conversation isn't being recorded out here. The testing committee is too busy to monitor everything leading up to the fourth test.
That's what I'm here for, and I don't plan on reporting this conversation. If you want to talk, this is as safe as it gets.
Do I want to talk?
Yes.
But do I trust Michael, or is this just one more test to be graded?
My father would instruct me not to trust him. As much as I want to be, I have proven over and over again since leaving home that I am not my father.
Michael hands me a sandwich from the basket and asks, "How are you holding up?"
My insides are churning, but I make myself take a bite of the sandwich. Beef, cheese, and a hearty wheat bread. It probably tastes wonderful. Swallowing, I say, "Malachi is dead. I watched him die."
"I heard." His eyes meet mine. "I'm sorry."
I believe he is. The sympathy I feel radiating off him makes me want to cry.
Why? Why is he dead?
A poisonous leaf, a nail to the eye, those are the causes, but the reason. Michael looks over his shoulder and then tells me to eat, to pretend to laugh and enjoy myself. Otherwise, someone watching at a distance might wonder what we are saying.
As I eat, he tells me that the testing process was designed years ago by Dr. Barnes' father, who believed that the seven stages of war occurred because world leaders did not have the correct combination of intelligence, ability to perform under pressure, and strength of leadership to lead us out of confrontations. That the only way to ensure the United Commonwealth did not repeat past mistakes was to test the future leaders of our country and make sure they had the breadth of qualities that would not only help our country flourish, but keep our people safe. Over the years, several Commonwealth officials have questioned the necessity of such strong penalties for failing the testing. Some even say that the testers rig the outcome of the tests so that those who are too smart, too strong, and too dedicated are weeded out. For those are the ones who feel not only compelled to rebuild the Commonwealth, but also to question its laws and its choices. Anyone who voices negative opinions about the testing either is relocated to an outpost or disappears.
Michael laughs as though he has said something funny. I laugh too, though nothing has ever seemed less amusing.
What constitutes too smart and too strong? Does asking to go outside mark me a rebel? My head spins, but I continue to smile as though my life depends on it. And it might. I eat the entire sandwich, then another because it won't keep in my bag, and I know I need to be well-fueled when I start the next test. Michael leans back in the grass and watches. When the sandwiches are gone, Michael glances at his watch.
10 minutes of freedom remain.
Are you scared? He asks, handing me a bottle of water.
I take a sip and feel emotions crash against the carefree wall that I had erected. I nod. Yes, I am terrified. Trying not to lose my composure, I slide the uneaten apples, oranges, and rolls into my bag. My fingers tremble as I try to close the fasteners. Michael helps me and whispers,
"Don't worry about being the first to arrive back. Every year, candidates think the order you return in matters. It doesn't. Be smart. Be safe. Trust your friends from Five Lakes if you can, but no one else. Every year there are testing candidates who think taking out their competition is the best way to ensure their entrance to the university. More often than not, they are right. Don't let them be this time."
The bag closes. I sit down as the world around me starts to spin and then fades to black. The last thing I remember is feeling strong arms lifting me while a soft, warm voice says,
"You're smart, Sia. You're strong. There are people like me on your side who know you can make it. Please prove I'm right."
Then everything fades away. The next thing I hear is water dripping. My eyes fly open. I am lying on a cot in what can only be described as a metal box. The whole thing is probably 6 feet by 6 feet. I try to squelch the panic I feel at being in such a small, confined space and take in the rest of my surroundings. There are electric lights illuminating the space. A small basket of food sits on the floor next to me. A toilet and tiny sink occupy the corner at the end of my bed. On the wall across from me is a countdown clock with a sign that reads, "Testing begins in 30 minutes. No, strike that, 29 minutes. I use the toilet, flush the grogginess from my eyes and the metallic taste from my mouth that are clear signs I was drugged. I think back to the water Michael handed me and feel a stab of betrayal. Then it is gone as I remember the whispered words. The drugs were part of testing protocol. His words and the care they contained were not. For whatever reason, Michael genuinely believes I will make it through this test. He even claims others I don't know are offering their support. I will not prove them wrong. As the clock counts down, I strip the bed of its sheet and stuff it into the bottom of my bag. Who knows when I might need the warmth? I then check the food basket, more sandwiches, dried fruit, a bottle of water, a small box of crackers, and 3 perfectly ripe strawberries. I eat the sandwiches, sniff the water for traces of drugs, and then sip at it while storing the crackers and the dried fruit in my bulging bag. If nothing else, I'll have enough food to see me through a week. More if I'm careful. One by one, I eat the juicy strawberries as I watch the clock tick down. When it reaches 5 minutes, I wash my hands, dig Zine's transit communicator out of my bag, and turn on the compass. The compass swings wildly, searching for direction, and finds none. I can only guess the metal box is confusing the signal and hope the situation remedies itself when I'm able to leave. 2 minutes left to go. I take one last sip of water and store the bottle in my bag. 1 minute. I realize anything could be outside that door. After putting Zine's communicator in the side pocket of my bag, I reach into it one last time. When the clock hits zero, I stand with my bag on my shoulder and the small black gun in my hand. The side of the metal box